true outcomes they want to entertain you today. Three true outcomes, insightful baseball news underway. You want to win that score sheet, you're gonna want to stay with Three True Outcomes.
Howdy, and welcome to the Three True Outcomes Score Sheet Baseball Podcast, presented by Baseball Prospectus. I'm your host, and I'm back from my Paleolithic lifestyle retreat, Ian Lefkowitz. And with me, as always, from Plymouth, Michigan, he's Hot Rachel, it's Ben Merkel.
You know how when, like, Dan Lebatard comes on a show, he's got that, like, BAM! Thing that he does?
I feel like... I never heard
Dan No Lebatard. Idea what you're talking about.
Oh, my
about.
God, you guys.
I don't pay attention to sports. I'm too busy following Unreal. Lifetime television for women's best show.
I need, like, a catchphrase. I need a catchphrase that I say every time Ian introduces me.
You do need a catchphrase.
Yeah, no, I can buy that.
So, I'm soliciting input for ideas for a catchphrase. That's how I'm doing.
So noted. And joining us from our nation's capital and already speaking a little bit, he's our host of Everblasting. It's Jared Weiss. Jared, how are you doing?
Sorry for speaking before I was called on.
It's okay. We'll forgive you this time. All right. It is great to be back. We have had a road trip. Thank you for bearing with our schedule. As a couple of us went on vacation through the hot, hot heat of Texas.
As if they had a choice about bearing with our schedule.
That's true. Our schedule is what it is.
We promise to refund 100% of money for everybody that complains.
But we're back. We're happy to be here. And we've got a corker of a show for you. Got some great questions. Going to talk about this year's draft just in time for it to have just ended. And we'll probably banter for a little bit about our jaunt through Texas and what we saw there, including actual baseball games being played by actual baseball players. But first, as always, a little housekeeping. We're getting some questions. You can email us at scoresheet@baseballprospectus.com with any questions you may have, any comments, thoughts, concerns, complaints about other podcasts, you know, make us feel better. Mm. We'll take those. And it's great to hear from you. In fact, we heard from many of you over the break, and to help us with that, throw it over to our mailbag captain. How is it going in the mailbag?
Super great. We got so many emails. I feel validated.
Your life has meaning again.
It's true. It takes so little. So the first email comes from Jacob, who has been despondent over our every other week schedule. We feel your pain, Jacob. He has a trade question. He was offered Donaldson, Andrew Miller, and Seth Smith for Joey Gallo, Byron Buxton, Moncada, and either Alfaro or Nottingham. He wants to counter with Nick Williams, Alfaro, Gallo, and round 40 for Jed Lowry, Andrew Miller, and Jeff Samardzija.
Is that reasonable? Okay. So what he's saying is that Gallo, Buxton, Moncada, and a catching prospect is a crossover catching prospect is a little too much to give up for Donaldson and Miller and Seth Smith, who's having a great year.
Your boy, Seth Smith.
Yeah. I have a really good trivia question about Seth Smith. That's really hard to get across, apparently.
It's a great question. I love it.
We'll get to that in a second. In the meantime, so Josh Donaldson, Andrew Miller, and Seth Smith for three great prospects. It's a hard thing. I would have trouble doing it.
Yeah.
That said, yeah, you know, I don't know. I think it would be done. It should be done, and I would never be able to do it. So I'm with him.
He does mention in part of the email that Jared didn't go through specifically that he thinks that even without a true third baseman, he could still win the league. And to me, like, reading through the question, I feel like that's too much future value for me to feel good about giving up for, like, a marginal improvement in chances of winning this year. I don't know.
Yeah, Donaldson's pretty great, but I feel like Gallo, Buxton, and Takata is enough to make my teeth itch, you know?
It seems like it shouldn't take all three of them.
Yeah. I two of three, I would probably do it. And I would want to hold onto Mankata as the one, but, you know, don't know if that could happen. That said, so his question is if he scales it back and goes with Nick Williams, Jorge Alfaro, Gallo in around 40 for Lowry, Miller, and Samardzija. Obviously, you're not getting as much back, and you're getting this crossover pitcher who is also Jeff Samardzija and is on my never draft radar forever.
He's not bad.
No, he's not bad, except when he pitches for the team that I care about, and I have to watch him every freaking week. And he's only good for the team I hate the most in the world. So I suggest Samardzija issues. But aside from that, it's fine. I giving up Gallo for... I would love to get something that I would enjoy keeping in 2017 if I were really popping Joey Gallo. I don't think Williams and Alfaro amount to a ton in a crossover league. I don't think I'd be like dying to keep either one. So in that sense, you're kind of trading away Flotsam, and I don't know how that feels, but Gallo alone for like Lowry, who's fine, but like kind of a backup player at this point, Samardzija, who's kind of a number three starter at this point, and Andrew Miller, who's great, but you know.
Reliever.
Yeah. I don't... Gallo's a high-variance player who really is, you know, behind the eight ball when it comes to finding a roster spot in the near term. But, I don't know that I could do that personally just because I tend to get very tight around my top prospects.
Yeah.
So, I would sit tight and wait for Sano to come back. Sano will be fine.
Yeah. Jared, any disagreement?
Nope.
Cool.
Makes sense. Okay.
Onward.
So the next question comes from Matt. I'll leave out some of the specifics because maybe we didn't need to talk about it on air, but we want to talk about it on air. So I think there's, if I'm reading this correctly, I think there's two different questions in the email. The first is... how to sell off pieces when you already have a ton of prospects. So if you're playing for next year and you already have lots and lots of prospects, what do you do? The second question is, he feels like he's maybe on the fringe of the wild card race. There are six teams within six games of first place. What do you do when you have guys like Trey Turner and Jesse Winker who are likely to be up at some point in the relatively near future?
Okay. I guess we'll take them one at a time. Because the first question in particular is fascinating to me as somebody who tends to, like, our teams tend to pile up on prospects because, you know, what else are we using those round 40 picks for? I think ideally you trade in for, obviously, the 2017 draft. That's the next place you go. And draft upgrades. It's hard to do. I think one thing that I don't know that we've had a ton of success doing, but might be interesting, is trying to trade, you know, some... If you're doing a two-for-one deal, making both of those pieces really interesting, like a good young player and a top prospect for an even better prospect, like could you get Urias if you traded away, you know, I don't know, like Reynaldo Lopez plus a, you know, third, like Alex Wood, let's say. I don't know if that would be enough, but, you know, it's that sort of thing where you kind of combine your prospects, maybe add a third prospect into the mix, and just try to improve your stock. I think these are obvious things, but, you know, there aren't really a lot of paths towards getting future value. So, you know, those are the ones to try, really. One thing I don't mind doing is looking out for players who are out for the year. You know, this is we're recording this on a Thursday. This will probably be up
tomorrow
before you know the news. You know, we heard that JD Martinez is going to be out for a while, maybe the whole season. I would send a condolence email to the JD Martinez owner in your league and then just offer 1,000 prospects for JD Martinez if that guy's competing. Like, offer a prospect, offer a replacement outfielder. Just try to improve your stock that way. Look for players who are going to be out. Look for players who are having down years and won't be useful in the playoffs. You know, play around with the major league roster as much as with the minor league side. And then maybe with your draft picks, try to draft relievers and players at positions who might be who have a lot of playing time, who you can kind of leverage if somebody gets hurt, I would say. Did I miss anything?
No, I think you said all the things I was going to say.
What? You have nothing else?
No, I think it's mostly about consolidating value. It's okay to have a ton of prospects, and if you think you don't want to have more prospects, then just get better prospects.
Easy as pie. Better prospects for everyone.
Exactly.
All right. So, how did you say the second half of the question?
How do you make the decision on whether to wait and see or sell if you've got guys like Trey Turner and Jesse Winker due up at some point?
Right. If your team is going to be, you think, good enough to compete by playoff time, but you're kind of falling out of the playoffs.
Yeah, or if you're like on the borderline and you think, you know, maybe you can make the playoffs, but, you know, how much can you rely on guys who are due up in a month or two?
It's tough. You know, I tend to think talent, as we've talked about many times, I think talent will out itself at a certain point. I think Trey Turner is going to get 200 at-bats in the major leagues. But when it comes to, like, what's happening in 1 month or within the next 6 weeks, that's really kind of goes out the window. You know, I don't know when.
He'll be up, but we don't know what his performance is going to be like.
Right. And I even if he's up in, like, 2 months versus 1 month, I just don't know when Dusty Baker's going to get tired of playing a veteran. Pause for effect. It's tricky. I feel like I don't know. I mean, we tend to think that our teams are second half teams. At least I do, just because we tend to draft young and we have players waiting in reserve on a lot of our teams. But you know what? Guys are always getting hurt too. So sometimes our second half teams are actually first half teams. What I mean by that is that I would tend to not really put that into the calculation so much as, you know, looking at how good your team has been on average, maybe the general projections and how many teams you're, like we talked about in the last podcast, how many teams you're trying to pass and how many games behind you are. And just going back to the fundamentals to decide if you should compete and maybe not trying to put your thumb on the scale. Because I know you can always think that, oh, you know, I have Trey Turner, I have Jesse Winker, I have young players, my team's going to get better. And then it turns out you have JD Martinez and David Wright.
Yeah. I'm in the middle of pulling up Matt's team, but when I read his email initially and Jared was bringing it up, it feels to me like the type of team we were talking about last time that gets tempted into trying to compete when it's probably in their best interest to sell. Mm-hmm. And looking at the standings, Matt's team is in last place, 7 games back of first place, you know, I guess 6 games back of the wild card I guess.
Right. So it's doable.
Yeah, but like, are you really going to be that much better than every other team in the league over, like, you know, the rest of the season when the evidence so far, and even like your plan maybe is to have not been that team? I don't think it's likely enough to make it worth going for it. So.
Right, especially if you can get, like we talked about in the first half, if you can get something out of punting.
Yeah.
If you can't do that, then...
Oh, well, he's got some guys that probably have some short-term value that he could sell off. Mm-hmm. And, the team will definitely be a little bit better next year.
Yeah, so it's definitely a good time to start thinking of that.
Yeah.
All right. Jared, what's up next?
I think we have
or do you have anything to add on this point?
No, I think it's good. I think we have one more question we want to talk about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It comes from Tom, and honestly, I can't top the first two lines of this email, so I'm just going to read it verbatim. So Tom writes, "How awesome is Jerickson Profar? Great or the greatest Ranger? As of the writing of this email, he has an OPS of 1.013. Thoughts and feelings on his future? Where will he go in round one of the 2017 mock?" So, I don't know, should we hand this one off to Ben, or...
I thought you were going to read the rest of the question.
Yeah. Well, I want to pull back the reins here. You know, I don't think he's a future Hall of Famer. Okay, Ben, go.
This guy's the most overrated piece of crap. In the last however long it's been since Tom sent this email, his OPS has fallen 150 points already. I responded to Tom at the time, citing Profar's 415 BABIP, and basically talking about all of the regression that was likely to happen, taking the troll bait. Nice job, Tom. I mean, this is just silly. He's got, like, far and away the highest BABIP of his career. At the time, he had an unsustainable homer per flyball rate that's come back to earth since. He's not really walking. He's not really striking out, but, like, I don't know. I think he's mostly gotten hit lucky and is going to be, like, a 700 OPS, I guess, decent middle infielder. I don't know. The most rosy projection I could find for the rest of his season online was a 730 OPS. And I think it'll probably be lower than that.
I will say this. We were, as explained before, we were in Texas for most of the past couple weeks. We went to the Rangers game at the ballpark in Arlington. And Jerickson Profar hit a couple doubles. And you can bet text messages and images were flying that night. So, Tom, you are not alone in your desire to troll Ben with photos of Jerickson Profar success.
So, Ben, it sounds like you've changed your mind and you're on the Jerickson Profar bandwagon. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, that's what you heard.
There's room. There's plenty of room.
There's going to be room. Bang. Sign me up for pocket-sized overrated pieces of junk.
One thing I do like about Jerickson Profar going forward, because the Rangers don't know where to play him, he may get like strange amounts of eligibility at a number of positions. Because of the way Score Sheet handles defense, he's not going to get the amount of eligibility that he should have. But
insert rant here.
Yeah, that's where we could go from Ben's rant to my rant.
Yeah, we just have like a rant handoff. I won't say I don't think Profar is like a rant of mine necessarily. It's just like you guys are wrong about this. I can't wait until he's out of baseball in 3 years because he sustains high OPS.
Because he's hit too well and for the good of the game he has to stop. I understand.
Wait, the line for how long Profar is out of baseball, you're saying 3 years?
I don't think that's the actual line.
That's the stated for effect line.
Yeah. Do you want to negotiate an actual line?
No, I'm curious, yeah.
He's young enough and he's got enough prospect stock that he's going to bounce around until he's 30.
Yeah, do you know how long Delmon Young played baseball?
Exactly. Exactly. And that guy was like a human piece of shit too, and so.
Like, yeah.
Can you imagine? I don't know if Profar is. I'm assuming he's not.
Cause actually, I think Jared knows exactly how long Dalvin Young played baseball.
Until last year, I think.
Oh boy. How did the Orioles make mistakes like that and just have it? Okay.
Dalvin Young's career OPS was 737.
And at his this playoff point, OPS, though, is like a million.
At this point, Jerickson Profar is like 50 points under that. So.
Yeah, but Profar can play positions where Dalvin Young can play.
Yeah, that's fair.
Pinch hitter.
Yeah, on DH maybe.
When
I looked up Dalvin Young's stats, the top news from RotoWire is Young was arrested in Miami on Sunday night from back in February. Nice. Good to know he turned over a new leaf. Anyway, this is tangents gone far enough, I think.
Really? I wanted to kind of spend the next hour on Dalvin Young. I think that's a valuable...
I mean, you can pick. You can talk about Dalvin Young or your trip to Texas, I guess. Nobody's going to stop.
We'll certainly get an equal amount of listeners. I think my favorite Dalvin Young fact, though, before we go, does he have, his overall wins above replacement for his career, -1.8? That's underwater.
Yeah.
That's a lot of at-bats to give to a below replacement player. He was so good as a 20-year-old. Anyway, how are we doing? Is that all for the mailbag?
I think so. We got a question from Josh about the draft, but I think you're going to talk about that soon. So thanks for the question, Josh. And maybe we can use that as a segue to the draft.
Yeah, and... certainly apologies for not getting the draft podcast out before the picks came in. You know, there was a really tight turnaround. Oh, I have a good rant, by the way, as long as we're here.
Sure.
So, like, I understand why Scoresheet had a June draft. The Rule 4 draft prospects were brought into the June draft because, you know, you would draft players, they would sign over a period of time into the next year for draft and follows. You kind of never knew when anyone was signing, and therefore everything was kind of murky and confusing, and you may as well just have the draft when it's starts. The thing is, it's 2016, and we know when everybody is signing. So why not wait until that happens? You know, give yourself a little extra time to find out who's signing and who isn't, so that people don't get hosed with, like, Brady Aiken news. And, you know, that by the end of July, everyone will have signed or not. And that way you don't have to, like, keep Kyle Funkhauser on your roster forever or figure out something like that. You shouldn't have kept Kyle Funkhauser anyway, if you drafted him. That's your bad. But
do you want to talk to the one person that has Kyle Funkhauser? Because I think we know who it is.
There were a couple, I thought. Oh, okay. If we scraped correctly, okay. I think more people had. I don't know if more people had Kyle Funkhauser, Jeremy Profar, Jerickson Profar's brother, but it was something of a toss up. That said, the draft actually took place, so players were drafted, players were signed, and. I guess with your permission, I'll just talk about that for a little while and talk about the AL and NL. And, you know, if you don't have if your draft didn't come up yet, hopefully this will still be of use to you. If not, either of use to you in future rounds or validation or, I guess, not validation for your pick. So I think in general, the way that we've talked about drafts in the past, and the way I still kind of feel about drafts, I think first round draft picks are generally overrated. With some exceptions, obviously at the top, you know, it's the only way to get superstar value. Really, you're not getting superstars, you know, as a 16-year-old in from free agent rosters. You know, you have to hope that major leaguers turn into superstars. So it's the only way to really replenish top level talent. But by the time you get to like the back half of the draft, people are usually drafting first rounders where they could be drafting prospects of equal value instead. And some of these prospects have been hanging around the whole time. You know, we talked all last year about Nomar Mazara. I don't think Nomar Mazara was owned in like what, like 50% of leagues at the start of the year, or it was, I think it was even lower. And like even by midseason, it was 50, like to 50 to 60% of leagues. And those are the kind of players who are every year still on the board while people are insistent on taking the 20th pick just because they were the 20th pick and they have a June draft pick. This one in particular is a little funny because this year's draft was, you know, I would say did not have the Bryce Harper, did not have your Steven Strasburg, or even somebody like Dustin Ackley, who obviously busted since, but had a lot of prospects seen at the time. You know, I don't think there is a flawless player who was taken. And, you know, I think there are a lot of... I think the draft was very... I don't know if I'm breaking new ground here. I think a lot of people are saying this. I think the draft was unusually rich in, like, okay or intriguing prospects. But I think... even in standard leagues, those kinds of players are fall even below draft radar. So I think there might be a number of players from this draft who become prospects, who become score sheet worthy. I think this draft is pretty low in players you should have drafted this round. That makes sense to you guys, right?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Ian, do you think, so I'm just like extrapolating here, do you think that means if you were at the top of like this round 40 supplemental, that it's better to use that pick on somebody that's already in the minors, or it's better to try to trade that pick for multiple later supplemental picks and like draft multiple guys from this draft? I guess what I'm wondering is, I hear you saying it's more of a quantity, not quality, sort of selection of players from the Rule 4 draft.
Yeah.
Is it even that they're high enough quality that they're even worth trying to take, or is it really just like focus on guys who have a chance of taking a great leap forward in the actual minor league systems already?
Yeah, I think at the absolute top, it actually makes sense to hold on to your round 40 pick.
Okay.
That there was enough talent that the first three or four teams in each league should be should have been fine taking a prospect, especially assuming that those are the teams who are non-contenders. It's kind of when the draft comes back around, or people towards the end of the 40th round who are taking prep guys. That's where I feel like, I mean, they are obviously aren't big mistakes just because the cost of blowing a supplemental draft pick is so low, but I do find that those tend to be pretty frequent mistakes that are made. You know, that's it. So things that we like. So we like taking college players in general for a number of reasons. You know, you know a little bit more about them. They're closer to the majors, which matters more in score sheet than it does in real life, because you're spending a pick for every year you're keeping the guy. And they're probably closer to being useful. You don't usually have to worry as much about a college player coming in and not performing immediately, or taking a couple of years to perform, where you have to just sit them on your bench and just like take losses from your keeper slots. And obviously, we take position players and skill position players over corner bats, over pitchers. That's, you know, almost tautological at this point. And you know, this draft was not set up to have a ton of them. So it was a little, I think, even more than usual. It's going to be hard to tell for a little while who's going to come out. I'm sure there, you know, just because we're saying there aren't a lot of players with, like, great upside. I can name plenty of players who were taken, you know, as theoretically safe picks who ended up having a ton of upside. Aaron Nola is obviously a great example of that. And I'll talk about one in a second, actually, or in a few minutes. I don't know if it makes more sense to do AL and NL. You know, because I set it up this way, I don't really have an AL and NL list in front of me. Maybe instead of this, and because it's not impacting your draft, I just want to talk about a few players who I like more than usual, or more than, maybe not more than consensus, but more than where they went in the draft. You know, I think sometimes people, especially people who aren't familiar with the draft, which is fine, you don't have to be, will just go down the list of players. And I don't think this was a particularly effective year to do that, because there were a lot of teams that were playing roster or bonus games or not immediately taking the top talents. And even teams who were expecting to take the top talents, I think what makes a great score sheet prospect is a little different than what makes a great real-life prospect. And I think some teams probably just also misevaluated. So starting with a few players who I liked more than more than where they were drafted. And starting with the player who is number one on my board. Not that my board matters for anything, but, you know, it's an amalgam of other boards. Plus this year having access to the SEC network and some other games. So Corey Ray, who I talked about a little in passing last week, was taken with the number five pick by Milwaukee, who had an excellent draft. Milwaukee, as I've mentioned a couple times, has my favorite farm system in baseball right now. Just, like, filled stem to stern with just, like, the types of players who I go nuts for. It's, like, position player heavy. It's all, like, performance prospects. It's just a dream. And Corey Ray is from Louisville. He's a kind of power speed outfielder, which is, as longtime listeners probably know, just like catnip for me. And the reason, like, you know, if you're in a fantasy league, like a, you know, roto league, you should draft him immediately. But even in score sheet, I like players like this because if you do a lot of things well, like, eventually, like, you have a major league skill. And it may not be, you, like, even if you bust, you may not have all your major league skill. This was always my Jackie Bradley defense and why I was so high on Jackie Bradley back in the day. You know, that the speed didn't translate, or, like, the bat didn't translate, but he had enough defense to play, and eventually he had enough power, and now he has enough everything to play. Like, you know, players who have a lot of different tools have a lot of different ways to become successful, even if, you know, they grow into a different type of player than you expect. And that's what I like about Corey Ray. Is there a world where he's just an average player? Sure. I don't think anyone is a guaranteed star, but he seems like the closest thing to me. So that's my number 1-1 in the NL. In the AL, my 1-1 pick, and a guy who, we got in two of our three AL leagues, Zach Collins, catcher from Miami, who went to the White Sox, which, delightful. I mean, this is the first White Sox draft pick I have loved in a while, and unfortunately, including Chris Sale. So maybe the White Sox should not take my calls, but Zach Collins is a catcher for the Miami Hurricanes. Hurricanes obviously are, or not obviously, they're a College World Series team, if you don't know. Certainly one of the top three teams in the country alongside Florida and Louisville. And Collins is their catcher. Now, is he a catcher in the pros? I don't know. I think teams that, like, so my philosophy, when people say, like, oh, he's not going to catch in the pros, I don't know about that, because the team that takes him tends to be a team who has a vested interest in thinking that he will. And because you're a score sheet owner, it doesn't matter if he's any good. He just has to play there. So, you know, I don't think the chances are high. I wouldn't, like, say that he's a catcher, but... yeah, but I think, you know, there's a 10% chance that he could be there, and that's a really powerful. Also really powerful is Zach Collins' bat. He can hit the holy hell out of the ball. He's crushed the ball in SEC this year. And it's just like a... Not just a good hit, but like a hitter with just great three-true outcomes, like takes walks, hits for power, a lot of strikeouts, which is probably a little worrisome. You know, I'm not into, like, taking right side only. He's a switch hitter, too. But, like, right side of the defensive spectrum players, which he most likely will be. But he just seems like such a good hitter. It's... like, probably too obvious to compare him to Kyle Schwarber, but he reminds me of Kyle Schwarber. So I'm really happy to have him. And I'm really upset that Brett Sayre shanked us by one pick in that one league where that we're in together. But it does mean that I'm probably not an island there.
That sounds like something Brett Sayre would do.
Yeah. In that league, we ended up taking Jason Grohm instead. So Grohm is the 12th pick. If you've been following the draft somewhat, you probably know that he fell a lot in the last week or so and had been talked about for most of the season as being a candidate for the 1-1 pick. He was a local boy to Philadelphia. He's, I think, from New Jersey. I am, as you'll hear pretty soon, I'm not, like, dying to take prep pitchers, especially like right all that often. That seems like a way to really blow your draft. Just because, like, you know, David Paulino is probably available in your league. Just take him instead. He's just as good as like a prep pitcher. But I think where I draw the line is, you know, sometimes you hear about these players who have where you hear general reports, ace stuff over and over again. They're like Lucas Giolito had that kind of rep. And Lucas Giolito pick doesn't look amazing this year, but hopefully Boston won't be like, oh, Jason Grimm, you did a great job. Please just change the entire way that you pitch this season. We want to protect you from yourself because we know best because we're the Washington Nationals.
What sorts of organizations do things like that, though, Ian?
Yeah. It always is that most protects people from themselves. But, yeah, I think he has good odds to be a future ace, and that's an immensely valuable score sheet property. If he is the kind of pitcher who people expect he is, he moves. Even though he's a prep pitcher, he moves quickly. Like those pitchers, I think, can outpace hitters if they're really really talented. They come up quickly because they're just obviously good. You know, is he a perfect pitcher? I've heard he walks too many. I haven't seen him play, unfortunately. I haven't seen any of the high school kids play. But, just from the reports that I was reading and from the same sources that you've been reading if you're an avid, if you're somebody who follows the draft avidly, he seems like the kind of profile where I would be willing to lift my draft order recommendation. Let's see. Matt Theis, the number one prospect in the Angel system now. Also the number one prospect in the Angel system. Literally anybody that would have drafted with that pick. Matt Theis, he's a different kind of player than Zach Collins. Collins was, a great power hitter for Miami, who kind of had patience and discipline. And Theis was, contact first. It doesn't strike out a lot. Also big-time school, not SEC, but Virginia, certainly. has had a lot of exposure on the national stage, has looked good as a hitter, also has defensive questions, probably not much more likely to stick. But I would say I prefer Collins to by a not insignificant margin, just because I wonder if Theis will have power, if you know he'll even have enough contact in the big in the pros to like really do anything. But players who don't strike out a lot, who don't strike out at all, are interesting too. And there's that chance that contact hitters can kind of outpace their potential. And you know, there's a chance that he sticks a catcher, in which case he doesn't have to be any good to be or to probably be above average keeper. Kyle Lewis was drafted with the 11th pick by the Seattle Mariners. He's another player who was probably kind of being bandied about in that 2-3 range. And he ended up going. He ended up going 11th. Just murdered the ball last year, and he or this year in spring for Mercer, he hit what is it 395, 535, 731. Whew. Yeah, I know. That's like your college numbers, right? Or your high school numbers, right? Or like if you were the best player on your high school team, except in college. That said, Mercer is, you know, a small time school. And, you know, I don't think it's a case. I don't think you can really trust numbers. And, like, when you look at the profile, there's a question of whether he will hit enough to be a worthwhile fielder and, you know, to carry a corner back, because it doesn't look like he's going to stay in center. And, you know, score sheet is not particularly kind to like right-handed, non-elite corner outfielders. Is, you know, that's not a particularly valuable property. That said, I think he's probably, just because you'll know pretty quickly, I think he deserves to go within the top 3 or 4 picks in the AL. In the NL, Delvin Perez was taken, was it the 23rd pick? Yes, the 23rd pick, which I have committed to memory. That's good. I don't have my parents' birthdays committed to memory, but I know where Delvin Perez was picked. Perez, if you've been following, was, the player, the 17-year-old shortstop who was, tagged as having behavioral problems, or what is it, like, you know, the rumors of, like, personal issues dogged him for the entire draft until last week, where he was, like, popped for PEDs, and everyone was like, that's what I was trying to insinuate. Just like, okay, put that on record. So, I don't know how much you believe PEDs impact a player's performance, but or if you have a moral objection to a player who takes PEDs, I can get over both halves of that. And I think he's a incredibly valuable pick because he has star potential, especially if it was not enhanced. Which you can't say about a lot of players in this draft. The big knock for me on him and why I ended up taking Jason Groem over him was that he's 17 years old. He's so far away. And, you know, if the power doesn't come, you're spending a lot of years just developing him, which is fine. It's an asset, and you can certainly trade him before he ever makes the majors. You know, if you just assume it's an asset that'll grow. But it's going to be a little while before you see a return. If that doesn't bother you, I think he's worthwhile to have on a score sheet roster, probably yours, and I think he'd be a pretty high pick of mine in the NL. Jared, you're back and listening, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. This is my chance to jinx the Orioles and say that...
You jerk, stop talking right now.
I really like the Cody Sedlock pick. I don't think the Orioles maybe.
Did you hear who he compared himself to?
No. Who did he compare himself to?
Jake Arrieta.
Cool. So. Well, I'm looking forward to Cody Sedlock's Cubs career. Yeah. I don't have the most faith in the Orioles to develop a pitcher. I know. That sounds pretty crazy.
I don't understand.
Yeah. Did you see that Zach Davies is pitching really well?
Sure did.
Yeah. All right. That's what he'd be, what, the sixth starter on your like fantasy team where you had a competent development staff? if you can get around that, I think he's worth looking into. You know, because it's the real world, the organization definitely dings him a little bit, but there's a lot of talent there. Lastly on my list, so I really like Dakota Hudson. I haven't watched, I wouldn't say I'm like a scout at all, so that's out. And then even among that, I wouldn't say I watched these players enough to really like form a judgment. That said, I did watch a bunch of the first round pitchers this year, and Dakota Hudson was the best one I saw. I don't know that he's necessarily the most projectable one. You know, AJ Puck does throw 97, so I understand why AJ Puck would go ahead of Dakota Hudson. But Dakota Hudson was the better pitcher. And for him to go 34th to the Cardinals is some quality Cardinal devil magic there. Especially after taking Delvin Perez. Cardinals had a distressingly nice draft, I think. For someone who does not enjoy when the Cardinals have nice drafts. I would take Hudson ahead of a lot of the NL picks after the top tier. I would take him over. I kind of want to say all of the pitchers. in the NL, especially. I would take Grom ahead of him for sure. I probably take Puck ahead of him, even though I'm going to ding him in a second. Would I take Justin Dunn ahead? I don't think so. I don't think I would. Part of it is that I wouldn't take any of the pitchers all that high. So in that sense, that's not like a ring endorsement, but I think Hudson is somebody who may be available in your league, even next draft. And I would kind of look to pull the trigger there. Just a couple other players. I would probably want to see Gavin Lux get rostered. The prep shortstop who was taken by the Dodgers. I think Josh Lowe is interesting. I probably feel like he's going to get overdrafted a little too high just because he was the fourth or fifth, I don't know, like the fifth AL pick. So those kinds of players get drafted all the time for just because they're the fifth AL pick. I like Lucas Ursug, who is the 46th pick. If you're looking for really deep fun, I'd be interested in taking him. I like Nolan Jones a little bit, although there's questions as to whether he's going to sign, but I assume, you know, this is 2016. Pretty much everybody signs. I think he'll sign. Peter Alonso is probably not a great score sheet prospect. As a first baseman, I don't really love non-elite first baseman, but he's the first baseman for Florida, the team as we speak, who's probably most likely to win the championship this year. I think he's of interest if you're in a deeper league. And I would say my pick to click, to quote my Stockholm Syndrome for Hawk Harrelson, would be Brian Reynolds, who is the 59th pick. from Vanderbilt. He's certainly not the best player in the Vanderbilt outfield. The guy he was standing next to is going to probably be the number one pick next year, Jared Kendall. But again, he strikes out a lot, but that's some power speed combination, just the way you like to draw it up. Maybe stuck in a corner, maybe a fourth outfielder, may not hit, make enough contact to be worthwhile, but there's some upside there. The fact that he went 59th is just, you know, it's not something I understand particularly well, and it seemed like at least the, you know, the people who know more and talk about this stuff also seem to agree with that assessment. Just to switch to the other side, so players who I like less than the draft order, most of the top players, to be honest, most of the players who were drafted at the top. Mickey Moniak, I like just fine. He's a little slight. He may not hit for power. It's score sheet. You don't need that in a center fielder. And he'll probably stick in center field. He wouldn't be my number one pick in the NL draft. I would be upset if I took Corey Ray, or if I took him ahead of Corey Ray. I don't know if I would take him ahead of Nick Senzel. I probably would go with Senzel. I don't love Senzel either. So Senzel was the number two pick, went to the Cincinnati Reds from Tennessee. So I'm going to... This is what I was leading into very early in the conversation. So Nick Senzel is a... one, let's say, big time college bat this year, and that's the kind of player who tends to go 1-1. That said, a lot of his game was BABIP driven and just him hitting line drives everywhere. I am not delighted by college line drive hitters in general. He picked up some power this year, but you know, it's really high. It's 360 BABIPs. And I look at Nick Senzel, and I just think of a couple players. I think of Zach Cox, who was, like, almost exactly the same kind of player. I think Senzel's better. But Cox was somebody who is going to be, let's say, a top 10 pick and kind of slid for financial reasons, but then completely busted out and was like just total BABIP line drive fluke. And it reminds me of Dustin Ackley, who also rang up huge BABIPs, had a sweet line drive swing, had that 70 hit placed on him, didn't really, and you know, it just fizzled when he got to the higher levels. I would say the counterpoint, and if you want to look at the high end of Nick Senzel, there are a couple players who I was also like particularly low on coming out of college. You could also compare him to Evan Longoria, who had kind of the same questions about, you know, is the power going to come? He was seen as more of a safe choice coming out of Long Beach State. He hit for more power. You know, he just... Longoria was the better hitter, but it wasn't by a ton. It's a difference of degree, not kind. I think the same thing happened with Troy Tulowitzki. They were both doing it out west. I think park effects being what they are, it's harder to hit home runs out west, and they may have been a little underrated. I think they're kind of both better hitters than Senzel in college. But if you want to look on the bright side, that's what you could see. For me, I would ding him a little bit. I think he's worth drafting high, but I don't think he'd be my number one pick. Similarly, A.J. Puck. I get it. He's, you know, throws 97. Strikes people out. He's been the number one... He's the only, like, number one pick who held his value for a year, throughout the year.
He's got five letters in his name.
Got five letters in it. That's as about as few as you can have.
It's tough to beat it.
Yeah. A lot of hyphens in his baseball reference page. He walks so many people. He doesn't have a lot of downward plane. I saw him. He was inconsistent all season. I saw him in his bat. I didn't get to see a good AJ Puck star. I saw him in his bat appearances. And just, you know, everything high and outside, high and outside, high and outside. Could not just get the ball down. Secondary was just fading out. He strikes a ton of people out. So I get the upside. I see it. He wouldn't be off my board. I'd take him at a certain point, but I don't think I'd take him ahead of Grom. And I don't think I'd take him ahead of Collins. I think he's third on my board. I don't know that I'd take him ahead of Kyle Lewis. I probably would. But I don't think he's that lock number one pick. Even though he probably has enough upside to do so. I think, you know, you could see him be, you know, a Tyler Glasnow type, like wild man who throws strikes, or, you know, I think he comps to Sean Newcomb with, like, if you attach Sean Newcomb's arm to a rocket. And the injury scares me too. Like, hearing about some back injury, I don't know. I would take him, but I feel queasy.
There's no such thing as a good back injury.
No. No. Rest in peace, David Wright. I would kind of group the next group of players who I'd be less likely to take than consensus together, and I call them just like prep arms, like Ian Anderson and Braxton Garrett and Matt Manning, just down the list, Forrest Whitley, just all of the prep arms. Like, they're all exciting. You know, every 19-year-old who doesn't have a blemish is exciting.
Talking about acting? But,
no, they probably all have blemishes in that sense. But, you know, they haven't been touched on. Their record is perfect. They all have gleaming fastballs. They all have great secondary. They can spin something. You know, they look nice on paper. And they haven't had to face competition yet. So, you know, it's wonderful. I would like to see these kinds of players throw once every five games. I'd like to see them strike people out in low A. You know, I'd like to see them not walk 40 and 40 innings just for a season before I start getting excited. You know, the streets are paved with prep arms who have kind of busted out. And, you know, it's just, it's a case where, like, you look every draft, you know, the Rays alone have, like, Jamie Schultz, they have Chi-Wei Hu, they have Jake Faria. These are all players who are striking out a batter inning in the upper levels. You know, we were in, what was it, Frisco, and saw Connor Sadzik pitch. Connor Sadzik took 5 years to get his stuff in order, but now he throws 100, and he's striking out a batter in inning in Double A. You know, I feel like if you're not talking an elite player, if you're not talking like a future ace, there are players at least as likely who just come around nearly every supplemental, and I would be really hesitant to kind of put too many of those guys on my team unless it was a particularly deep league or a league that loves prospects where you feel like you could trade these guys if you need something. And, you know, I think that means for sure that I'll miss out on some of these players. But and some of them will become the stars that you expect. But I'm okay with that. You know, I'm a little resigned to it. Next, I would say Blake Rutherford of the Yankees, a guy who, I don't know, I guess fell a little bit He ended up with the 19th pick with the Yankees. I guess that was – or 18th pick, I'm sorry. I guess that's about where he was expected to land. I think it was – he was probably ticketed for low teens and ended up in 18, which is about average. Prep outfielder, I think he was getting a lot of buzz. The issue I have with him, in case you didn't notice, is that he's a year older than everyone he was playing against in high school, and he's actually 19. And he wasn't, like, lighting up the league. So, I don't know. If you're inconsistent and you're also old for your level, are you Bubba Starling? You might be Bubba Starling. It's not enough to take him off my board, but that's not great. And last, I would say another group of players, relievers. I don't really love the idea of taking a future reliever. So Zach Birdie, who throws even harder than his brother, I think, who is one of the hardest throwers in baseball. I think Zach Birdie touches 101. He was picked with the White Sox at 26. I think he's going to be a... I think he's going to end up being a reliever. I think the White Sox actually want him to come up as a reliever, although I would love to see him as a starter. That kind of thing just takes him off my radar completely. Just because, you know, I don't think relievers have a ton of value in score sheet from year to year, and I definitely don't think relievers in a draft who are not coming up immediately are just seem like a blown pick. Like, what if you get 20 innings out of this guy, and you know, next year, and then that's it? Or because, you know, he was on the roster for 3 months and he lost his eligibility that way, or, you know, you get him for 40 innings, but he's just okay, which is entirely possible. You know, there have been plenty of relievers who turn into Ryan Wagner or Nick Howard, who from Virginia a couple of years ago, who just completely lost the strike zone. Not every, like, future ace reliever taken in the first round is worthwhile. So Zach Birdie, you know, Dane Dunning was a reliever who ended up with Washington. I think they're probably going to try to start him, but that worries me. Jordan Sheffield, who it was a starter with Vandy, and just, like, walked the ballpark. Probably going to end up as a reliever in the majors. You know, I wouldn't be delighted to take any of them. Robert Tyler. I don't know. Well, Tyler is a hard thrower who's probably going to be converted and also a Rocky. So don't take Rockies. Riley Pint is pretty far off my list at the moment just because the upside is a Rockies starter.
Think of all the great team name puns you could make off of Riley Pint's name, though.
After seeing the possibility of Corey Ray Jepsen, I'm stuck. There's nothing else for me.
Can't top that one.
Can't top it. That's all. I would love to talk draft if anyone has any particular questions about their player. You know, there are some players who fell to, you know, Alec Hansen was a famous guy who fell to 49th. I would love to see him turn it around because he signed with the White Sox, or he was drafted by the White Sox. I wouldn't spend a pick to think about that. I would cut Kyle Funkhauser if he was still on your team, and I wouldn't draft him again. That guy was a mess. I heard he got better by the end of the season, but that was not even like a minor league player. And there are some really interesting players if you want to talk about guys I love in the third round, but that's not really for score sheets so much as my own weird neuroses. And most of these guys you don't have to think about again. So enjoy. All right. Done. Sorry, and sorry about the timing once again. We were on the road. I missed the draft, which should tell you how terrible that was for me.
That's partially because we were in Central Time Zone and had trouble figuring out when things were going on.
because it was on fake time.
Yeah, it's fake. It's confusing.
Ian, you also missed the basketball game tonight.
Did I, though? Did I?
And more importantly, the Copa America quarterfinal tonight.
Oh, yeah, of course.
U.S. beat Ecuador. USA. USA.
The Cavs won, in case.
I can't believe I missed Harold Reynolds just talking nonsense for 4 hours, though.
Yeah, how can you miss just that? Jeez.
While sitting in a parking lot at Secaucus. It's just, ugh, what a dream that is. So, just in case you guys are frustrated, believe me, I share your frustration. That's about it. Should we move on to the goofy stuff?
That wasn't the goofy stuff.
you just talked for like half an hour about players that nobody can draft anymore.
I can. You want me to go another half hour?
That's not what I said.
Okay. So we went to Texas.
Let me go first real quick.
Okay.
The best thing I saw was Poultry Days. It's an awesome, huge party tournament. It was a lot of fun. The end. All right, go. Tell us your stories.
All right. We went to Texas. Should we start with the baseball? Probably, right? We'll keep it as baseball-related as possible for as long as we can, which might be a minute or two. We saw, like, six games. What did you think of the Texas ballparks in general? Do you have a review?
I was glad to see them. I think they're both fine stadiums, but I think if I were to put my rankings together, they'd probably come out slightly below average.
Yeah, I think both of them. I feel like Houston needs to raise its game a little bit. It's a fine stadium, but I was going to say the in-game felt a little sleepy. Needs a refresh, especially for a team that's been, you know, so active in other areas.
Yeah.
Although we were there on Prince night, and it was a Prince tribute fireworks night.
That's a thing.
I will say after the game, yeah, which was heartwarming. Orbit came out, right?
Orbit's the mascot. Yeah.
Orbit the mascot. Everyone knows who Orbit is. Come on. Yeah, everyone.
Sure.
And Suede.
Especially me.
Yeah, Suede to Purple Rain. And then a couple of members of, I guess, the family? Is that what?
Orbit has is a that family?
Well, no, like Prince of the Family, like like the lady, like Apollonia, the Apollonia of Orbit world, came out and ripped some tearaway clothing from Orbit.
The Astros cheerleaders.
The Astros cheerleaders came out dressed in purple. Started, I would say, lip sync battling to "Let's Go Crazy," and then brought out the Prince guitar. And from which fireworks shot out.
Yeah. The mascot was playing guitar with fireworks shooting out of it. It was pretty amazing.
So
that's pretty cool.
High marks to Houston. That's maybe the first time I've seen a mascot do something mascot-y that actually made me laugh.
That's good.
So there you go. We went to four of the minor league stadiums in Texas. I think we only missed Midland and El Paso, which are out west. One day we'll get there to West Texas, a dream. But we did see we saw Round Rock, we saw San Antonio, we saw Corpus Christi. Did you have a favorite there?
Corpus Christi.
Easy for you to say.
Crispy Corpus.
Yeah. My favorite cereal, Corpus Christi. Made from real human flesh.
Whataburger Field.
Yeah, Whataburger Field is beautiful. What a gorgeous stadium. That's one of my just favorite views. All the minor league stadiums in Texas are a little on the quiet side. I get it, Texans. It's hot.
But yeah, nobody seemed terribly excited to be there.
Yeah. But that one was like really just gorgeous, up against the water in the harbor, and just gleaming and shiny and
maybe great. They would have been more excited if Jerks and Profar had been there.
That was probably it.
It's possible. Alex Bregman was off in Corpus. That's they should have been up for Alex Bregman. They were actually there were some knowledgeable people behind us, I would say, who were into Bregman and Derek Fisher. That was a good. That was a really good lineup that day. We didn't get fireworks from the player end, but we saw some good prospects. But yeah, I would say all in all, pretty solid showing. Texas, a little more enthusiasm.
Yeah,
everything should be bigger in Texas, including your emotions.
I think Ben would appreciate our biggest disappointment on the trip.
Which was?
So we went to Dr. Pepperfield.
Oh, sure.
And Ben, where is Dr. Pepperfield? I don't even know.
Dr. Pepperfield is in Frisco, Texas. It's
Sure. I've been there.
And so, Ben, you're someone who likes Dr. Pepper.
It's true. I do like Dr. Pepper.
Right? And so we were excited because we figure at Dr. Pepperfield... Obviously, like Dr. Pepper, but like we get some maybe slightly exotic flavors of Dr. Pepper.
There's no such thing.
Well, yeah, there's like cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper, right?
Well, that's just okay. All right. Anyway, continue.
You could not find cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper at Dr. Pepper Field. You were lucky if you could find Dr. Pepper at Dr. Pepper Field.
Yeah, I don't even think they had like diet.
Yeah, it was horribly disappointing.
If you're playing a Dr. Pepper Field, you would better just like have a fountain of Dr. Pepper in the middle.
Or like a Dr. Pepper slushy icy kind of thing.
Would be good. That would be
right?
Good.
That would
be good. Yeah, which we had. We had a great we went the next day to the Dr. Pepper Museum in Waco, Texas. The Dr. Pepper and Free Enterprise Museum. Which is about the history of Dr. Pepper and also objectivist thought. And, hand to God, and also weird commercials from the 1970s and 1980s starring Christina Hendricks and Reba McEntire.
And Cyndi Lauper.
That said, they had maybe the best soda jerk I have seen in my life. My life has not been filled with soda jerks, to be fair, but we had a little... I had a little Dr. Pepper float that was magical and like just spritzed like 4 or 5 times like a piece of art.
This woman took pride in her craft, and I really appreciated it.
Yeah, I love anyone who takes pride in their work like that. And if you were ever in or near Waco, Texas, go to the Dr. Pepper Museum if only to get a little Dr. Pepper float. You will not regret that. Yeah, and that's about all for baseball. So, Jared, I've got 2 things lined up. So, just in case, so we'll probably talk at the end about the actual best thing we saw this week, which probably for both of us is the same thing. But we also did a road trip, and then we stayed in Austin for a little bit to talk about. To go to a little TV festival. From the road trip, Jared, what was the best thing you saw this week?
The road trip, best thing I saw. It was probably, tacos maybe. And
great this week, yeah.
The barbecue at Pecan Lodge.
In Dallas, Texas.
Did you go to Torchy's Tacos?
We did not. We could not make it to Torchy's.
We went... Yeah, but there were tacos everywhere, and they were delicious.
Well, obviously.
Cheap and tasty and amazing.
They weren't Torchy's, though. That's a failing. We have to come back. I know. We came very close. We were minutes away, and then went to... we decided to go to Salt Lick Barbecue instead of Torchy's Tacos. We need to... Texans, we need to talk about Salt Lick Barbecue for a minute with you.
Yeah, Salt Lick is not where it's at.
It's not good. Stop recommending this to everyone.
It's not bad, but you have better barbecue there. Recommend
it's
that.
It's fine. Yeah, you have so much great barbecue. You have the best barbecue in the world. Recommend that instead. Don't
North Carolina.
No, sorry. I love North Carolina barbecue. I love vinegar. Don't get me wrong, but it's not the best.
Yeah, North Carolina's best slaw in the world, and I would put Lexington up there. But that brisket at Franklin's. Just
mind blowing.
Yeah, they're nothing.
Game changing.
Yeah, nothing in the world is better. And even like Pecan Lodge, which is now, I believe, the second best barbecue we ever had.
Yeah.
May also be the second best meal we've ever had. So yeah, recommend those instead. Don't recommend Salt Lick. Stop it. Everyone recommends Salt Lick to us. We appreciate it. It was nice that they went out of their way, but please don't do that anymore. But that said, those were sad things. So I have two things, to bring up, and feel free to take either one of these if you want. One we saw in Kilgore, Texas, and one in Luling.
Yeah, well, there's also the Alamo thing.
Oh, the Alamo. Yeah, no, that's true.
So, Ben, if you had to guess a rock star that was really into the history of the Alamo, and I'll narrow it down a little bit. Let's say a classic rock star.
I feel like
really into the history of the Alamo. If you had to take a guess, who would you go with?
John Cougar Mellencamp.
It doesn't matter who you guess because you're going to be wrong. The answer is Phil Collins.
That's fine.
Phil Collins is hugely into the Alamo.
Is one of the world. So I think you should let. This is one of the world's leading Alamo experts and traders of rare Alamo artifacts.
Phil Collins.
to the degree that rare he went Alamo to artifacts? That he went to a shop, which is a block north of the Alamo, which you should do as well. We had a wonderful time there. I genuinely recommend this wholeheartedly. Even if you are from San Antonio, if you've not seen this, go to that first before you go to the Alamo. I can't say it's better than the Alamo.
I'd say it's better.
Yeah, I can't say the opposite either. But so Phil Collins once went into this rare bookstore, which is just a little bit north of the Alamo, about a block north. And,
it's a rare bookstore, map shop, and weapon shop.
Yes. So it trades in old trinkets, and asked them if they had any Alamo stuff. You probably didn't use the word stuff. And they said something to the effect of, no, we don't have a ton. And he said, that's a shame. Let me buy this store.
Because, of course.
Yeah, and so he became part owner of the store, and he said, he also said, well, you know, I also have this artifact that I want to display, this full-scale model replica of the Alamo as it stood, which you can't see anymore, actually. You know, I don't know if everybody knows this about the Alamo, but most of it was, in fact, destroyed. And the part that you remember as the Alamo is just kind of the church, which was kind of one piece of the mission.
Is that why we're supposed to remember it? Because it's gone?
Yes.
I see it now.
But so he has a full scale model replica of the Alamo in general, and if you pay the very nice lady who runs that shop or who is operating the shop,
they're rather fetching him less
a $5 fee.
What
you can in fact have
fetching.
I just said me. She's so attractive, right?
You and your middle ages friend can listen to a 13-minute light and sound feature from none other than Phil Collins before heading to the Alamo. Highly recommended.
13 yep. minutes.
And worth every minute.
I just want you guys to know that next time you ask me to go on a trip like this, stories like this one are why I don't think I would have a good time. Because that sounds horribly boring to me.
Your loss.
That's fine. I'm fine.
No, it wasn't, though, because, I mean, well, okay, I guess it depends on your opinion of military history. But it was, I mean, kind of interesting to understand what actually happened at the Alamo, because while I have a vague idea, I think this sort of illuminated what actually went down.
I had no idea, and I'm perfectly okay with that.
Yeah, I genuinely, hand to God, learned a lot from Phil Collins. About the history of the Alamo. And I went out knowing more than I came in. And just about the battle itself and about its placement in Texas history. So, fair play, Phil Collins. You convinced me. Next, should we... We should probably head over to... what is it? Kilgore, Texas? Talk about the East Texas Auto Museum?
Yeah, you should do that.
So in Kilgore, Texas, which is about 2 hours east of Dallas and or everything on Earth, there is a community college, Kilgore College, which is home to the East Texas Oil Museum. The East Texas Oil Museum, a highlight of East Texas, is I feel like I can describe it best as a museum about the 1930s as described in the 1970s and never updated since.
So you,
yeah, you walk in and all of the displays are essentially frozen in amber, right? there was obviously like a lot of investment to just build the thing, and they stopped immediately thereafter. So you head in and first play around with a few trinkets about oil and learn literally nothing about oil. If you ever go to some museum and there's just like stuff displayed wantonly, we see that in a lot of museums. It's not the best curation, but it shows that you really gone to a good homespun museum. And then you go back into the second room and there is a full scale replica of downtown Kilgore as it would have existed in the 1930s, including animatronic figures.
Yep.
Or life scale figures, and like a guy who an animatronic man who laughs at you from the pole in the corner, and then you walk down the main street, and the main street is covered in plastic mud, and it's actually dangerous, like you could sprain an ankle in a genuine way, which I like in my museums, the element of danger. But that's not all. So you head through Main Street, Kilgore, and you go to a Five and Dime movie theater, and you go in to see a movie about the history of Kilgore. This movie, in keeping with the spirit of the museum, is narrated by, I'd like to say, a man who is somewhere in between his mid-40s and late 80s, made up to look just like... made up to look either 40 years older or just like wildly crazy. He speaks to the audience. So he's introducing the history of oil in East Texas as it happened in the 1930s, but he's an actor. So he's either narrating it as it happened in the 1930s or looking back on it from a time in the future. And it's impossible to tell which. You cannot tell. So it's like, back in my, you know, when I was here with Miss Fanny, and she was helping out with the kidney beans, you're like, what are you talking about? You do not understand what is going on. And in the meantime, this narrator also, what I didn't tell you about this movie is that in addition to this narrator prattling on about nonsense for like 20 minutes, it's also animatronic, and it's also a 4D movie experience, including lights, sound, and a scale model of Kilgore right in front of you, and they dig down through the earth. And when they dig down through the earth, this came up a lot on our conversation thereafter, they tell you how the people of Kilgore struck oil, and I'll try to describe it as I heard it. So, you know, when you're looking for oil, you want to dig down. You want to dig down deep into the earth. And what did the miners do? Well, they went through the earth, and they found a layer of sandstone. And beneath that, a layer of limestone. And then a layer of sandstone. And then a layer of limestone. Then another layer of limestone. Then another layer of sandstone. Then sandstone. And then sandstone. And more sandstone. And then a little more limestone. And then back to the sandstone. Some more sandstone. Some limestone. Limestone, limestone, limestone. Little sandstone. Some limestone. Layer of sandstone. A layer of sandstone. Layer of limestone. A layer of limestone, 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 sandstone, a layer of limestone, layer of sandstone, and then they struck oil. And you're like, what happened?
Hey, why is that exaggerating? It went on for like 5 minutes. It was insane.
Why are you doing that? With a model showing you as it goes down deeper into the earth, in between the sandstone and the limestone. I cannot fathom what must have gone through the minds of the people creating this. And then finally, they strike oil at the end of the and not to ruin the suspense, I urge you all to head to Kilgore, Texas, and discover this. When they do strike oil at the end of the film, which after some things are said, and I'm not sure what, to be frankly honest, they strike oil, and all of a sudden, your seats start shaking, and the rumble strips start going. They've hit oil, and your seats start shaking, and hand to God, they do not stop shaking for about a minute and a half. They just keep going. Like, you get the point within the first 30 seconds. You're like, oh, I see what's happening. And it just keeps going. And then turns into like a shiatsu massage. And then it just like, it never stops. It essentially, the museum is just like a giant rape joke.
Oh.
It's like 100 museum volunteers stepping onto 100 rakes at once. It's brilliant. It's everything I want from a small town museum. And it's almost the best thing I saw this week. Later that week, we went to Luling, Texas. After spending the morning in Lockhart eating barbecue like a madman, we decided to go down to eat more barbecue.
When Ian says we spent the morning eating barbecue, we stopped at 3 barbecue places before noon.
Yeah, nice work, guys.
We're on the barbecue trail, and nothing, including our health, will stop us. We went to City Market in Luling, Texas. While we were there, we noticed a couple things in Luling, Texas. We get in to the town looking for the barbecue place. She's on the corner. It's not a big town. You'll find it pretty quickly. You've got 3 blocks to work from. But as you're driving in, you see the water tower, and then you see a sign that says "Vote for Lexi." You go, okay, school play or whatever, prom queen, something like that happening. See another sign that says "Vote for Lexi," and you're like, well, Lexi's got a lock on this town. And we parked. We headed down into Main, and you start seeing there's like a vote for somebody else, and you're like, okay, so they're competition. Great, I love it. What are they voting for? We walk up to the market, and then we see a sign, and the sign features a lovely young lass of about 16 years of age, smiling at the camera in a kind of like prom theme photo, while giving the biggest grin and saying, holding a watermelon. And they say, vote Lexi for watermelon thump queen.
Thump
and
queen?
Immediately, I have a million questions.
Like, what is a watermelon thump queen?
That's a good question.
It's a start. What is the watermelon thump?
I mean, I can imagine what that is.
Beyond your imagination, I promise. The watermelon, okay. The watermelon thump. Now in its 63rd year, is the local festival. So that is so it's a not just a smash. Not just we're not just talking about Gallagher.
I don't think they actually smash a watermelon at any point during the watermelon thump.
No, there's a seed spitting competition.
Oh,
there's a team seed spitting competition.
For seed spitting competition for adults. There's a parade. There are, classic 4-H stuff. And of course there's
a melon auction.
There's a melon auction. There's the biggest melon. And of course there's the watermelon thump queen.
Thump queen. Yeah.
And thump like thumper, like
yep.
A bunny.
Okay. Sure. Yep. Exactly. You got it.
Nice. Nailed it. Okay. What's a thump, you ask? That's an awesome question. A thump in 1954, somebody like the local chamber of commerce in Luling, Texas, was like, we need to have a down-home local festival. What should we call it? And they held a naming competition. And some genius fifth grader, who I hope is a titan of industry, decided we should call it a thump, a watermelon thump.
What does the watermelon have to do with the thump?
Well, it's a thump. The thump is the party. The watermelon is the subject.
Okay. So could you have, like, a cantaloupe thump also? Or is that, like...
Sure.
Is that, if like, they don't, if biennial? The people in Texas don't sue you first, yeah, absolutely.
I'm not too worried.
So if you're interested in learning a little bit more, so the thump has a queen of the thump festival, of the watermelon thump, and she is a 16-year-old junior at Luling High School, or rising senior, I think, who spends the year basically in a direct democracy, trying to compete, vie for the title of Luling Watermelon Thump Queen. And this weekend, Luling will be choosing its Thump Queen, as you read this, or as you listen to this. There are 8 young girls who are all competing for Watermelon Thump Queen. And what does that take? There is an article from September 2009 in Texas Monthly Magazine that describes what it takes. And what it takes is 24/7 effort. They wake up early, they go out, they fly. They have flyers, they stand in the middle of town, they direct democracy, they talk to every single person in Luling and try to get, you know, some representation and try to get their name out there to become Watermelon Thump Queen. One of the girls has business cards. They all have pictures of themselves holding watermelons, either a piece of watermelon, a whole watermelon, a half of watermelon, wearing watermelon paraphernalia.
Multiple watermelons.
Multiple watermelons. They get out at, they go home late at night, they wake up early in the morning, just trying to get the vote out to become Thump Queen. And how much money goes into it? I don't know. A lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort. And the Thump Queen, once crowned, gets to sit at the head of the Watermelon Thump Parade, and represent Luling, Texas, at all the other towns, and go to a number of parades as the reigning Watermelon Thump Queen. It's wonderful. I'm really invested. The Watermelon Thump liked me on Instagram. I immediately followed. I'm looking forward more than ever to find out who the winner is. I like Priscilla as a dark horse, but Madison's got some action, and Lexi has really, really covered the town. So I'm really excited to find out what happened. And I hope you all share our enthusiasm. And have a water weekend on behalf of the people of Luling.
Is there something about Luling that lends their festival to being about watermelons, or is it just that they really like watermelon?
It's there. I'm sure they have watermelon farms.
Yeah, presumably they grow watermelon there.
Yeah. It's more, once you've got the festival, then the watermelon store just kind of pops up. The Chamber of Commerce starts selling watermelon paraphernalia. You can get right now a 62nd annual Watermelon Thump Festival shirt for half off, in case you want to go out there.
Interesting.
But the new merch looks great. No, they have watermelon patches there. I'm sure they have them in neighboring towns too. But damn it, this one has a festival, a thump, in fact. Thump.
Yeah.
And they were putting up some of the decorations at the Thump Pavilion while we were there. So. I'm very excited for the thump, and genuinely hope that it gets it's treated with pride and exists forever. And that would very nearly be the best thing we saw this week. Except, Jared, what was the actual best thing we saw this week? Other than each other and company.
Well, if you throw that out, So we went to the ATX Television Festival this past weekend in Austin, Texas. And they were doing the 10th anniversary Friday Night Lights reunion, which was held on Panther Field in what we'll call Dillon, Texas, just outside, just next to the Austin airport, where much of the cast reunited. You got to see the field house and the locker room for the Panthers. We were treated to a performance by Creasy Victorious, along with two other much lesser bands, and a screening of an episode of Friday Night Lights on Panther Field.
Which, and it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you are a Friday Night Lights fan, which you should be because it's the best show on television, it was, I don't know, it's hard to put in words, but it was an experience that I'm glad I didn't miss.
Yeah. You know, one of a kind, just a one of a kind time. You know, I we were meaning to go to Texas for a long time anyway, just because we hadn't been. But you know, I wouldn't, certainly some of the animating force behind going to Texas is because of this great story that was told there. And just being able to be in Dillon for an afternoon, even a fictional, even for a moment, even with a bunch of other crazed Panther fans. That's something I'm not going to forget. And thank you to all the people of ATX, the organizers and the volunteers who put it together. That was a real, just a real treat. With that, I think there's only one way for us to sign off. So on behalf of Ben Murphy and Jared Weiss, I'm Ian Lefkowitz. Thanks again, and Texas forever.
Texas forever.
Three true outcomes they want to entertain you today. Three true outcomes, insightful baseball news underway. Three true outcomes, come on out to the ballpark and play. Three true outcomes, Ian, Ben, and Jared. Scoresheet baseball can be tricky if you don't possess the edge. They'll call it the way they see it, you'll rarely hear them hedge. They each possess the knowledge, honed from years of play. You want to win at Scoresheet, you're going to want to stay with three true outcomes they want to entertain you today. Three true outcomes, insightful baseball news underway. Three true outcomes, come on out to the ballpark and play. Three true outcomes, the number one independent score sheet podcast in the US of A.